Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Hello, welcome to the This Is Money and Share Radio podcast. This is Sue for Georgie Frost this week. You can catch the Consuming Issues programme every weekday from 9 until 1 on digital in London, online at shareradio.co.uk. And if you have a smartphone or tablet, via the Share Radio mobile app, which is free to download. In the studio with me today for our weekly catch-up is editor Simon Lambert, who's back. Simon, good morning.
Good morning, Sue.
And alongside to deputy editor Adrian Lowry. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Hello both. We've a lot to get through. Coming up after a series of hard-hitting speeches at the Conservative Party conference, Simon and Adrian give us their reaction to the key points raised and proposals set out, including David Cameron's plan to fine parents for letting their children skip school.
It's about the children. If you're a child and you miss school day after school day, your education's it gets a setback. And if your education is setback, your life chances are setback.
Over 120,000 people have already expressed an interest in buying shares in Lloyds Banking Group since the Treasury announced that it would make £2 billion worth of the shares available at a 5% discount. Here's the Chancellor, George Osborne.
This final sale will be the biggest privatisation in over 20 years, and I don't want all of those shares to go to city institutions. I want them to go to members of the public. We'll favour small investors and we'll help create that share-owning democracy that we want to see in this country.
So are these shares worth getting your hands on? The This Is Money team investigate. We talked Tesco too. The supermarket giant yesterday saw its profits drop 55%, despite managing to halt the quarterly decline in sales. All this during a week where Tesco and other major stores have had to deal with the impact of the 5p charge for plastic bags. Would you be interested in slashing the cost of your train journey to just £1? I'm sure the overwhelming answer is yes. We have the hints and tips on how to unlock this later. And another question for you, as well as the award-winning This Is Money team too, how well do you know your mortgage? Well, assess why interest rates have remained so low for so long and why car insurers are to become alert to the more weird accident claims and how you'd feel about committing to a longer-term investment plan. And we're talking here a period of between 15 and 20 years. Now, Simon and Adrian, I wonder if you both remember this.
And all because the lady loves milk tray.
It's famous the world over. It's got to be, hasn't it?
Indeed.
What was it?
It's the milk tray ad, isn't it?
Of course it is. Do you know that the milk tray man is back on the telly tonight?
Apparently so.
Yeah.
And I've already set my video recorder.
Have you? That's interesting news from Simon Lambert. Tonight, spearheading the look for a brand new figure to play the milk tray man, or possibly the milk tray woman. That might well be where the ad franchise goes in the future. We've been asking today here on Share Radio whether or not you remember certain adverts from the past, and it might be because it had a catchy jingle or a catchy tagline, or it might well be that it had that ongoing storyline like the Gold Blend adverts, Annie Weston. A lot of people remember that because it was like a long-running soap opera. What do you remember?
I remember that the ads were definitely better in the old days, weren't they? Definitely better. The one I always remember, well, actually, one that cropped up recently was the "If only everything in life was as reliable as a Volkswagen" slogan, which is unfortunate. But I always remember the beer ads. So things like the Holston Pills production adverts and also the Carling Black Label one, especially the one with that squirrel.
Yeah, those they felt great. Like epic numbers, didn't they?
And there was also the John Smiths, the two sort of northern fools fooling around.
A well-crafted ad that may only be on screen for 30 seconds can really have a vast impact, can't it?
Yeah.
Especially when you have a character or a tagline that seems to really transcend the generations. We've been talking this morning about the Flake Girl. We've been talking about the Shake and Vac advert.
Love that one.
What else have we talked about today?
Well, I'm going to test you now. If I give you the name of the brand, you can tell me what the slogan is. How about that? So John's come in with American Express.
You can't use it in any shops.
Or don't leave home without it. Paul's come in with a BT slogan.
BT?
Yeah.
BT.
Oh, come
it's
on.
Good to talk.
It's good to talk. Well done. And a more recent one as well, comparethemarket.com slogan is...
We're really annoying.
Or simple.
Simple.
That's the one. And finally, Kate has mentioned the Gillette adverts, of course.
Oh, it's the best a man can get.
It is the best a man can get. Very good, everyone.
So clearly all these billions of pounds of resource that goes into ads is rather lost on you, Simon.
Oh, I don't think it is. I think of all the things that I've retained in my life, advertising slogans are probably up there in the top 10.
I just don't watch them anymore, though, because, you know, I watch all my television on catch-up or on... Or I record things in the old-fashioned way on the Freeview box and the adverts get fast-forwarded.
Perhaps that's why the agencies and the marketeers behind tonight's resurgence of the milk tray man are actually releasing this information today in the hope that maybe we won't just step away for a moment or we won't press fast-forward, that actually we will actually give it the 30 seconds that they hope it deserves.
Maybe, maybe.
Could you see a woman in the role?
Why not? She couldn't be called the milk tray man, though. She'd have to be called the milk tray woman.
Milk tray something else, yeah. The team are here this morning, here on Share Radio, as we bring you their take on some of the major financial stories of the week. This is Sue Dugan, listening to Share Radio, of course, on digital in London, online, and through the Share Radio mobile app. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, are in the studio for our weekly catch-up with me, running through some of the stories they've been looking at over the last 7 days. Editor Simon Lambert is here, Deputy Editor Adrian Lowry, too. Who's looking after the shop while both of you are here?
Oh, well, we've got the whole team back at the office, but we've got our personal finance editor, Rachel Rickard-Strauss, and our news editor, John Hopkins, in the hot seat, so everything should be fine.
And all listening in, we hope, as well. Now, loads to get through today, from the public stampede to snap up Lloyd shares, Tesco's profit plunge, snapping up train tickets for just a pound, and where to stick your money for the long term. But first, the Conservative Party conference has come to an end in Manchester. So what did we learn about what's next for the pound in your pocket? Let's take a look back with our reporter, Anna Jones.
On Sunday, tens of thousands of people took part in an anti-austerity march.
They're elitist, they only care about their own class, and we're here to say we don't agree with that.
Justice Secretary Michael Gove described some stars involved, like Charlotte Church, as comfortable millionaires. She wasn't impressed.
I can't imagine that he is in such constant contact with lots of normal people as I am.
Outside the hall itself, delegates were egged and spat at on their way in, with cutting tax credits one of the major complaints. The Prime Minister insists it's the right thing to do.
The concept and the introduction of this higher wage economy combined with lower taxes and reduced welfare, I think, is fair for all.
But not every cabinet member agrees. London Mayor Boris Johnson wants a rethink.
We must make sure, as we reform welfare and as we cut taxes, that we protect the hardest working and the lowest paid.
Other political party leaders traditionally stay away from the city where the conference is being held, but not this year.
But we're here to say there is a different and better way of doing things.
The Prime Minister used his speech to launch a bitter attack on the Labour leader.
My friends, we cannot let that man inflict his security-threatening, terrorist-sympathising, Britain-hating ideology on this country we love.
He also pledged to shut down any hate-preaching schools and tackle poverty. The Home Secretary's speech suggested there's no case for high levels of immigration, sparking an angry reaction from charities and the Institute of Directors.
This is an economically damaging position to take.
Despite the speculation on who'll be the next leader, David Cameron insists he'll stay until the end of this parliament.
Simon and Adrian, what was your overall reaction to how the conference went and the issues that were raised and some of those key speeches as well?
Well, I think that obviously the Tories think that they probably had some kind of own goal this year round, because they've decided that Jeremy Corbyn is bad news for the Labour Party's chance of getting elected. But to focus on the things that they were talking about, I think they were pushing this agenda that they tried to push in the election of hard-working people getting ahead, which is just sloganeering, isn't it? But one of the issues that they've got coming up against them is this row over tax credit cuts. But they also talked about building more homes, which is going to put them in direct conflict with many of their voters who don't want more homes in their backyards. And also there's this, you know, situation where they are saying, this is what we're going to do for the next 5 years. Come on, let's make Britain great, you know. But I'm not so sure that they're not going to avoid some form of downturn over that five-year period.
What do you recall most, Adrian, this week?
Well, I think Simon's exactly right. I think the two most interesting aspects that were talked about were the tax credits and the home building and the housing crisis. I mean, it's the first conference after a, you know, surprisingly convincing election win. I don't know how much you can sort of take in terms of concrete financial proposals from it. There were aspects of the conference that were slightly rabble-rousing. They're obviously full of confidence. There was a lot of playing to the crowd, etc. So if you're going to choose a couple of things that actually will have an impact on people's lives, then probably tax credits and house building are the two that stand out.
On tax credits, there was a stark warning from Unison over David Cameron's plans for these tax credit cuts, saying that they'd leave more than 2.7 million low to middle income working families across the UK significantly worse off. Here's Pete Challis from Unison, who says that despite the new living wage, he says it's not enough to counteract the effects of what the cuts will bring.
If you take someone on the national minimum wage, they currently earn £11,830 on a 35-hour week. Their pay will go up to £13,104 next April if they get the increase in the enhanced living wage, what the government calls the national living wage. But they'll pay a bit more tax, even though the tax allowance goes up. They get an extra 80 quid out of the tax allowance. They'll pay a bit more national insurance, but they'll lose about £1,600 in their tax credits.
Unison say that 2 in 5 working families with dependent children could lose as much as £3,000 from next April. Do Unison's figures tally with yours at This Is Money, Simon?
Well, Unison's figures are very similar to the figures that have been put out. I mean, I think the Tories dispute some of the stats that have been put out. But what I would say about tax credits is that, unfortunately, the people who are going to face the brunt of dealing with the tax credit situation are the low paid. They're the people who get the tax credits. And I don't think that we should, you know, do down anyone who's losing £1,600 out of their income, because for those people, £1,600 is an awful lot of money. But the problem with tax credits is that basically we have a situation in this country where large employers get away with paying people less money than they need to live on because their incomes are supplemented by tax credits, by everybody else, by the rest of the taxpayer. And that means that these large companies get to make more profit and then they get to give more money to their shareholders in dividends. And I think that basically what it means is that the taxpayer, us, you know, as taxpayers, are supporting companies making larger profits than they should be and paying their staff less money than they should be. And I do think that we do need to wean ourselves off this situation. And actually, funnily enough, that's something that I think Jeremy Corbyn is actually in agreement with the Tories on. He spoke about this situation of low wages and tax credits and essentially subsidising the profits of large organisations. Now, unfortunately, I don't know any way that you're going to get yourselves out of that situation without someone being hit.
What's the reaction been via the This Is Money website this week? Have you had the public telling you whether or not they're broadly in favour of having their income boosted, whether it's through tax credits, whether they favour that, or whether they're looking ahead to the living wage?
Well, I think there can be a certain amount of knee-jerk reaction that, you know, it's a benefit, it's somehow creating a kind of welfare dependency and therefore should be removed along with various other benefits. I don't think that's really the case. I mean, it was introduced as a way to incentivize people to stay in work, low-paid jobs. And with the sort of Tory One Nation, Cameron's kind of One Nation emphasis of being, you know, a party that includes everybody, it seems odd to a lot of people that he's chosen this to cut back on. Then again, what Simon says is absolutely right. It's quite an inefficient system for the objective that it's trying to achieve. And I think probably the only way around it, the only way, you know, to solve this problem is to, you know, increase living wage. That will hurt small firms. So you then have to subsidise small and medium-sized enterprises to pay a higher living wage. And then there will be a clear benefit of, or a clear advantage of coming off benefits and working. But it does seem almost, well, not spiteful, but it does seem kind of counterintuitive that, you know, the Tories should be talking about aspiration and moving people out of sort of benefit dependency when tax credits were meant to be that thing that did that.
Let's also look at some other points raised at the Conservatives conference this week. We also saw the appointment of Lord Adonis as the head of a new infrastructure commission. It'll make big decisions about things like transport and housing. Of course, the announcement, you've talked about this, of 200,000 new affordable homes. Good news for people struggling to get on the housing ladder, do you think, Simon?
Yes, it is. I mean, we don't build enough homes, you know, objectively speaking. We need to build more homes in this country. The exact figure as to how many we do need to build is a matter that's up for some debate. But there is this situation where we do need to get more big infrastructure projects built, but also small infrastructure projects. You know, it would be nice if somebody just went around and fixed all the roads, to be perfectly honest. You don't actually need to build this whacking great big high-speed 2 train line all the way up to Birmingham that people are very dubious about the benefits of to get the economy going. In fact, a great way to get the economy going would be to spend more money on fixing roads.
But promising to fill in a pothole sounds like less of a promise than building something that costs billions.
You shouldn't fill in the potholes. You need to resurface the roads. That's short-term thinking, isn't it? And that's why the potholes come back. But to go back to the building more homes thing, I think the real issue is, and also with the infrastructure, is that the government is going to bump right up against its own voters who are going to say, that's fine, but we don't want it here. And our colleagues on Money Mail actually went out and met some of the NIMBYs this week. They went to Hertfordshire, they went to the town of Baldock and to Nebworth, and they spoke to the people there who are protesting about new homes. Yeah. And what they said is, I think, very true of many people who live in the southeast of Britain, where a lot of these new homes want to be built, is they said, there is not the infrastructure to support this. We don't have places in the schools. They've closed all the hospitals. The trains are full to go into London. The roads are full if you want to drive anywhere. And yes, we have lots of open green space, but what are you going to do with all these people? And I think that is very true of a large chunk of the country.
And shall we talk about skipping school as well? David Cameron has come under fire for his tough plans on those parents whose children regularly bunk off. £60 is the first penalty, rising to £120 if it's not paid within 3 weeks, and then automatically taken from child benefit if it's unpaid after 28 days. How does it feel to you? Let's just hear some thoughts on this.
It's about the children. If you're a child and you miss school day after school day, your education's it gets a setback. And if your education is set back, your life chances are set back. And if we want a society of genuine opportunity where children from the poorest homes can get the very best opportunities and can make it to the top, we need to make sure truancy is a thing of the past in our schools. Now, there's a system of fines for parents whose children are persistently truant. What we're saying is make sure those fines are paid by taking that off people's child benefit. And I think that would be a real incentive for parents to make sure they get their children to school every day. It is tough, but frankly, we need to take some tough action to demonstrate the true compassion of a society that says children should be in school because it's so good for their future.
That's David Cameron talking this week. And gentlemen, your views on this? I'm sure you're both very good boys here. Never, ever well, mixed class.
I'm slightly dubious about this kind of financial engineering. There are many ways that, you know, we try to nudge people's behaviour with fines and sort of penalties, you know, there's speeding and wearing seatbelts and things like this. And I'm not sure that education and the bringing up of one's children is really an arena to introduce financial penalties and to try to change social behaviour in that way. I'm not an educational specialist. I'm not an expert in, you know, kind of social behaviour or, you know, least of all in bringing up children. But I think attending school is something that should be addressed outside of personal finances, or you know, making sure that your children attend school is not something where fines should really be introduced.
Simon?
Well, I think there's two different issues, isn't there, surrounding fining people whose kids don't go to school. There's fining people for taking their kids on holiday during term time, which is an extremely controversial practice, and I personally don't agree with. I think that, yes, you probably need to discourage people from doing it, but I think depending on the age of your child will probably learn more in a week on holiday or a week's travelling than they will do in a week at primary school. But also, there's the truanting issue. And I'm not so sure whether people whose kids are hardcore truanting are really going to be able to get their kids to go to school just because they're being fined. I don't really think that there's necessarily a link between those two things. If you're a parent whose child is repeatedly not going to school and has a real issue with going to school, that must be very, very difficult to deal with. And the last thing you need is someone coming around and fining you and taking money off you. And also, that will actually probably directly disproportionately affect low-paid families.
I'm Sue Dugan. You're listening to Share Radio on digital in London, online and on the Share Radio mobile app. We're joined today by the Deputy Editor, Adrian Lowry, and the Editor, Simon Lambert, from the award-winning This Is Money website. More reaction to some news stories and money stories of the week in just a moment.
So So you want to learn to make the most of your money. Of course you do. But you want to learn while also listening to satirical songs and sketches. Of course you do. And that's why we invented Managing My Money. Let me move your rates up
and down. Let's talk. Huge debt. So I want the real big savers,
please stand up. Managing My Money is an official Open University course. You can take the test and earn yourself an Open University certificate to show how financially savvy you've become. So join Annie Weston and me, Glenn Goodman, every Monday at 9 p.m. And if you miss an episode, go to the Share Radio website to find out when it's repeated, or just download a podcast instead. It's never been easier to fill that hole in your no-zone layer.
This is Share Radio, and this is the This Is Money podcast, weekly on a Friday here at Share Radio on Digital in London. Editor Simon Lambert and Deputy Editor Adrian Lowry are with us today from thisismoney.co.uk, the award-winning financial website. Coming up, a look back in a week in business for Tesco, how to bag a train ticket for less than a quid, really. And we're seeking an honest answer to the question, how well do you know your mortgage? Perhaps the question ought to be, do you even know who your mortgage lender is? But first, let's take a look at some of the more popular articles on the This Is Money website. And that's that the public stampeded to snap up Lloyds shares. But if you want the discount, you have to hold off for now, as they're not actually available to us until next spring. Over 120,000 people already have expressed an interest in buying shares in the Lloyds Banking Group since the Treasury announced it would make £2 billion worth of them available at a 5% discount. Let's hear it from the horse's mouth. Here is the Chancellor, George Osborne.
We've got a big task here, which is to finally get the British government out of owning great chunks of our banking system. And we've made a lot of progress with Lloyds, but this final chunk, this final sale, will be the biggest privatisation in over 20 years. And I don't want all of those shares to go to city institutions. I want them to go to members of the public. And so our offer is this. Buy Lloyds shares. We'll favour small investors. We'll favour those who hold the shares for a long time. You'll get a discount, and we'll help create that share-owning democracy that we want to see in this country. And the process of getting the paperwork ready, making sure the prospectus is there, takes a little bit of time because those are the rules. But the shares will be coming on sale very soon. And as of now, there is a website available where people can register on the .gov website to make sure they're kept informed and that they can get in there and get these shares with the discount.
Well, that's the Chancellor, George Osborne. So the big question is, are Lloyds shares worth investing in? Simon, you've written about this. Before we get into the pros and cons of the share offer, just take us back to the beginning with Lloyds. Can you give us a potted history of the last few years?
I can, yes. And basically, Lloyds was a very UK-focused domestic bank that was always derided through the boom years for the banks in the 2000s as being a bit too boring. People were trying to encourage Lloyds TSB, as it then was, to be a bit racier, a bit more Northern Rock, a bit more like Halifax Bank of Scotland. Now, unfortunately, when the financial crisis arrived, it turned out that the Northern Rocks and Halifax Bank of Scotland of this world hadn't really been doing that great a job. And there was a point during the height of the financial crisis when we genuinely thought that Halifax, HBOS, Halifax Bank of Scotland, would go bust. And there was an arranged marriage between Lloyds and HBOS by Gordon Brown at the time, which was rushed through. And this turned out to be somewhat disastrous because essentially what happened was we married up a bank that had massive problems in terms of HBOS with a bank, the only main UK, you know, retail bank that didn't have that many problems in terms of Lloyds. Unfortunately, the new amalgamation of the two turned out to not be very good, and it had to be rescued by the taxpayer, who ended up taking about a 40% stake in the bank. And over the years that have passed since then, there's been a lot of work done to improve the balance sheet, to make the bank better, and the government has been selling off chunks of it, but only to institutional investors. Now, the retail investor, or to put it in normal person's language, the man on the street, the ordinary investor, is going to get a chance to buy some Lloyds shares. The offer was announced this week and it's going to take place next spring.
And in your article, you make the very prescient point that the great irony is that many potential buyers will probably already have lost a load of money on long-term Lloyds shareholdings thanks to the financial crisis. and what you call the arranged marriage with HBOS as well. And they're the ones who probably now are registering their interest somewhat strangely.
Yeah, rushing to. In fact,
Or is it a strange decision?
No, it's not. So I must say, I did start my column with the line, "Dear investors, we plan to sell you a stake you already collectively own in a bank you rescued," is not how the Lloyds share sale offer page starts. But that is effectively what the government is doing. It's saying to people, we've got these shares, we'll swap you £1,000 worth of these shares for £1,000 worth of your money, and we'll offer you these sweeteners to do it, which is they'll give people a 5% discount to the market price at the point when the share sale goes ahead. They will give them one free share for every 10 they hold, if they hold onto them for 1 year. And also the other main attraction on offer to investors is the fact that by that point, Lloyds should probably be paying about a 5% dividend. So all of those things together, if you invest £1,000 and people who invest £1,000 or less will get priority, means that you would effectively get back £200 on a year's worth of holding the shares, providing the share price doesn't fall. And that is what is attracting people, is the opportunity to join in a big privatisation and make a quick buck. And yes, many of them will have already lost substantial amounts on Lloyds, myself included.
Yes, well, that is the attraction of this, isn't it? I think a lot of people look back at Royal Mail and sort of saw how the shares in that privatisation rocketed in the first few days and weeks after the float. It's a slightly different situation. Well, you know, it's a very different situation here, obviously, in that, you know, the shares are already floated. It's only 10 or 12%. I think another 1% was sold by the Treasury, which now takes down their holding to 11%. So that's how much is left. How much of that ends up in small shareholders' hands, I don't know. But it's fair to say that it's very unlikely that the shares will see such a sort of meteoric rise in the first few days of trading. And also, there are incentives. I don't think you qualify for the discount, do you, until you've held on to them for a certain amount of time?
Yeah. The discount comes immediately, but you don't get this one free share until you've held them for a year.
So it's obviously trying to stop people flogging them off quickly. It's meant to encourage an army of small shareholders. I think holdings under £1,000 will be prioritised. So
I wonder if you find that an interesting move and potentially a political move, because that's encouraging people who've got a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit of money to
play with. Well, it's going back to this idea that really gained credence under Thatcher with the major privatisations of the 80s, you know, trying to turn us into this shareholder democracy where people have stakes in these big companies and hold them to account. I think that only works if people hold on to the shares into the long term and actually take an interest in how the company is run. There is a constituency of small-shareholder retail investors out there that will do that. However, I think in these kind of mass floats, there are a lot of people who are just hoping to make a bit more money on their shares than they do on their savings account.
What about those who already own shares in the Lloyds Banking Group? Will the 5% discount share hurt the value of someone else's investment?
No, it shouldn't actually make that much of a difference. It probably will make a small dent in it at the time when the share sale goes ahead, but it will only be like maybe 1% or 2%. So, I mean, the thing is with this kind of mass privatisation, so if you're investing in individual shares, what you should be doing is you should look at a company. You should evaluate its balance sheet, its prospects, the price of the shares, the opportunities for growth and all these other things. You should be reading through the company accounts and you should be doing a lot of due diligence before you put your money into that company. Unless you're investing in a mass privatisation, which point all those rules go out the window. And I said that this is basically, if you're going to indulge in a spot of reckless investing, something like this is the way to do it. And that's what the Royal Mail share sale was. And Adrian's right in that the difference between the two is Lloyds is already on the stock market, so we know what the price of Lloyds should be, what the market says the price of Lloyds should be, whereas Royal Mail arguably was underpriced. But if you do look at those Lloyds shares in detail, they don't look too bad a prospect. So in terms of the opportunities for growth, there's not a huge amount there. It's our biggest high street bank. It's probably not going to grow much bigger, but its fortunes are directly related to the UK economy and also the UK property market. If you think those two things are going to trundle along nicely for the next 5 years, then Lloyds isn't a bad bet. In terms of the value, well, the thing about bank shares is that basically nobody likes banks at the moment, and they are still very lowly rated compared to the market. So the valuation on Lloyds shares is quite low. If sentiment improves, that valuation could rise, and you could see the Lloyds share price rise from about the sort of 70-80p it's at now to maybe a pound, and then you would make some money on the shares. But then also, if you look at the income prospects, which is the dividend from the share, that's quite good. Lloyds has said it's going to pay out at least 50% of its earnings in dividends, and some, you know, city analysts and fund managers expect that to be closer to 60 or 70%. That means that prospective dividend yield for 2016 is 5%, and one fund manager, Alex Wright of Fidelity Special Values Investment Trust, he thinks that maybe in 2 years' time, going at today's price, if you bought those shares, you could be getting a 6.5-7% yield. Compare that to 1.5% on a savings account, where obviously your money is protected and safe, and that looks quite attractive.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
Editor Simon Lambert from the award-winning This Is Money website. Deputy Editor Adrian Lowry is alongside too. During the week that the 5p plastic bag tax came in, the supermarket wars continue to rage on as some fall off the conveyor belts and others cling on. What's the latest casualty? Well, it's Tesco. Their profits have plunged by 55% to £354 million, despite the supermarket giant managing to stem the quarterly decline in its sales. Tesco revealed a 70% plunge in half-year profits for its UK and Ireland business, but international sales nudged up 1% with a growth in both Europe and Asia for the second quarter. So what has gone wrong for Tesco? Maybe we should start with plastic bags, first of all, and whether or not you both predicted there'd be a bit of a ding-dong at your average checkout this week, and what your listeners have said over whether or not they've taken umbrage with this 5p charge.
Oh, yeah, I think a lot of people have. I don't think they have any right to, really. I mean, I think this should probably have been introduced a long time ago when it was in Wales and Scotland. It does make people think. I like to think that I will, you know, always take a bag out with me when I go to the supermarket. I don't always go to the supermarket from home, though. I, you know, quite often go on the hoof. You don't always have a bag with you, but I've got to say, in the last few days, I now actually do think when I leave the office, I have a hunt around in my desk and I find a carrier bag and I take it out with me because it's just that reminder.
There you are. It's encouraged you to be socially
responsible.
Exactly.
It's nudging. Nudging, I believe they call it.
Nudging, yeah. I had visions this week of people conveying their groceries, you know, by the armful back to their car boot, you know, balancing, you know, bags of potatoes on their head, that kind of thing, in order to simply avoid paying it. But I think it probably will long-term encourage a change in our shopping behaviour, won't it? On to these big figures in the business itself. Let's look at the story in a little bit more detail. A 70% plunge in half-year profits. The profits this week announced to have plunged 55% to £354 million, although the quarterly decline in sales has been arrested. Simon Lambert from the This Is Money website. Are Tesco beyond the worst now?
That's a very, very good question for people. And I don't know what the answer to that is. I think Tesco is a very, very big business. And in ways, it is a very, very good business. But in other ways, it's not such a great business. And the problem is that if you are a gigantic supermarket like Tesco, you have very, very large fixed costs. And if you also make very, very small margins, which is what supermarkets do, when your sales fall, you get disproportionately hit. And so that's why we've seen the halving of profits, when actually, if you look at the stuff it sells, it still sells an awful lot of stuff. It still sells
tea bags and potatoes.
I think it's like £1 in every £8 that's spent on the high street goes to Tesco.
So what have they done wrong then?
What have they done wrong? I think that they basically took their customers for granted. And I think that's true of most of the big supermarkets. I think that they just piled them high, sold it cheap. Mm. They didn't really pay too much attention to what customers wanted, and they allowed the discounters to step in and say, actually, maybe you don't want these gigantic supermarkets with endless rows of stuff that is constantly moved around so that you can't ever find anything. Mm. Maybe you want a smaller amount of stuff with the emphasis on quality. And actually, I think that's where Tesco went downhill, is it didn't put an emphasis on quality. And that is actually where it's improving. If you look at the food that's in Tesco shops now, it is markedly better than it was a year ago.
You mentioned the smaller discount chains as well. Lidl this week has announced it's branching out in the world of online shopping. Sainsbury's last month reported better than expected figures, and Aldi and Lidl together have showed some strong performances lately.
And Asda yesterday revealed very strong results for last year, actually. I think it broke £1 billion in profit.
What's the knock-on effect this week of all these various announcements been on Tesco shares?
Well, the shares have done all right, actually. They actually rose on the day that the results came out, which goes to illustrate quite how bad everyone thought the results were going to be. And then they did all right the next day as well. And then we had this slightly bizarre story that involved the boss, Dave Lewis, going out and buying a load of shares, having repeatedly been quizzed as to why he hadn't bought shares, and saying, and he responded and said, no, we've got this rule that says, you know, senior people have lots of inside information
figure.
On Tesco, and
figure,
we can't
yeah.
buy shares. And then he went out and bought some.
Yeah, he and four of his colleagues bought nearly £500,000 worth, actually, £445,000 worth of shares. Why did they do that? If they were making a big case against it, why have they made such a clanging U-turn on it?
With any company, especially if a company gets into trouble, there is or is struggling, there is always a lot of pressure on the senior directors to go out and buy shares, because director dealing is one of the things that investors look at to see, have these people got what's called skin in the game? Do they believe in the turnaround story? If they believe in the turnaround story and they think that the market has priced those shares too low, then they should be buying and backing their own actions. If they don't believe in the turnaround story, then they might be selling. So there is a whole like little niche of investing that just watches director deals. So Dave Lewis has been quizzed a couple of times, you know, by people about why he hasn't bought shares in Tesco. And he turned around, gave this excuse, and then went out and bought some shares. So maybe he does believe in the turnaround.
OK, so can Dave turn it around, do you reckon, Adrian?
Yeah, I don't know. He's up against a lot of the major trend that he's up against is the fragmentation of the kind of grocery market. It's not just groceries, let's not forget. It's, you know, clothes as well. Tesco did very well from selling clothes for a while, but then Primark appeared and, you know, they took a hit from that. But in the grocery market, people are moving away from the huge weekly shop. They are starting to think, I'll get a few things from Aldi, I'll get a few things from Lidl, I'll treat myself to a few things from M&S or Waitrose, and maybe I'll go and get my washing powder from Asda or Tesco. And that's what they're up against, I think, now.
But the key question there is, whose bags do you take to all of those shops?
Whose bags do I take?
If you're spreading it around a bit, whose reusable carrier bag do you use?
Well, I'll tell you one good thing that Tesco have done recently is on Friday and Saturday and Sunday last week, Tesco were giving out free bags for life to customers before this plastic bag charge came in. Rather than like trying to flog them to people, make that little extra 10p here and there, they were giving them out for free. And the thing I would say about Dave Lewis is he has managed to come in, they've cut a load of people, they've made a load of cutbacks, but he's still viewed very positively within Tesco. You know, sources within Tesco say that Dave Lewis has basically got the organisation with him. And he's also a brand man. He came from Unilever. And if basically what Tesco needs to do is improve its brand and make customers love it again, then he's probably a good person to do that. But like Adrian says, he's up against a big shift in shopping habits.
Shall we talk about loyalty points? There's research this week that shows that nearly £6 billion worth of unclaimed points from the top 10 loyalty schemes alone are just sitting there unused. Nectar tops the charts with their loyal members not using an amassed £404 million worth of points. That's about £22 for every member, just not being used. And Morrisons have announced that they're scrapping their Match & More loyalty reward scheme starting November 2nd. We spoke to personal finance expert Holly Mackay this week, who doesn't think that loyalty schemes really pay off anyway.
When you look at the Morrisons example, Match & More, which they've scrapped, was actually quite good because it was easy to take advantage of. You'd do your shop and they would do a price check against Tesco, Sainsbury's, Asda, and make up the difference to you in sort of points. So it was very immediate, it was tangible, it was easy. They're saying, oh, well, we've still got our scheme left and we'll do the more bit. We've just sort of got rid of the match bit. But it's not really more, because you have to spend, get this, you have to spend £1,000 to get a £5 benefit at the till. So I am personally highly sceptical of these schemes, and I think it's much more important for people to shop around and get the best price at the tills, because otherwise we sit on our cards, and then even when we do something, it's worth not very much.
Well, apparently, Simon Lambert's a bit of a sucker for a voucher, aren't you?
I think that life is too short for loyalty points.
Okay.
And I suspect that I may epitomise all of those people sitting on unused loyalty points who, frankly, just couldn't care less. Lots of people like loyalty points, but an awful lot of people just really can't be bothered.
I've never had a supermarket loyalty card. The only loyalty card that I have is for my local pub, where they give you a free pint every time you have nine. Not on the same night, I might add.
This is Share Radio, and this is Money.
Welcome to Share Radio.
And we're in company today with the team from thisismoney.co.uk, the award-winning finance site, editor Simon Lambert and the deputy editor Adrian Lowry. So far we've looked at Tesco's, why the discounted share proposal from Lloyds has piqued the interest of some 120,000 would-be investors, and we've talked about the Tory party conference this week as well. Let's turn our attention to the nation's favourite obsession, property, and the question is today, how well do you know your mortgage? Well, apparently for the average house buyer, the answer to that question is probably not well enough. Following from research from the University of Nottingham, who claim that people don't have a good enough grasp on mortgages, they asked 2,000 participants four simple questions on mortgages to gauge how well they understood interest and repayments. People who had a standard mortgage managed to get an average score of 2.57, in other words, a 64% correct answer rate. People who rented did significantly worse, 41%, and coming in a worrying last place were those with alternative mortgages, such as interest only, who scored on average 39%, a correct answer rate. So why don't we know a great deal about the ins and outs of our mortgage agreements then?
Well, I think there's two issues here. I think there's, one, the issue that a lot of people don't really know a lot about their mortgage. And you suggested earlier when we were off air, perhaps they don't even know who their mortgage lender is, I think,
isn't
it? I
had to think very long and hard this morning to remember mine, actually.
But the other thing is, I think that there's an awful lot of people who just aren't that good at maths or some simple maths, and maybe that's a gap in our education system. Because these four questions basically involve some stuff on simple maths and percentages and whether you'd be paying the mortgage off. And in some of them, you have to think about the numbers and everything like that and then work out which out of A, B, C or D is the answer.
I think it's one of those things, like mortgages, it's something that, you know, you don't deal with every day, you don't deal with every month, every year. It's something that you only have to tackle every 2 years, every 5 years, whatever. So at that point, you dive into it and you find out about it and you maybe go to a mortgage advisor or a mortgage broker and you're steeped in it for a few days while you choose your mortgage, and then you stick it in a drawer and you forget about it. And maybe the knowledge that you gained in those few days about how these different sort of, you know, fixed rates work and all the rest of it, that just kind of disappears because you've only got so much space in your head.
Yeah, you know, if you're locked into a deal for the next 3 years, it's pointless digging out the paperwork anyway, I suppose. Yeah. You're listening to Share Radio. This is Sue Dugan. With you every weekday from 9 through until 1 on Consuming Issues. Normally it's Georgie Frost who's back next week. You can listen on digital, online and via the Share Radio mobile app. We endeavour to make the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
We'll talk a little bit about getting het up about possible interest rate rises, but in the company of Simon Lambert and Adrian Lowry, they are editor and deputy editor, respectively, from the This Is Money website. Let's talk about train fares. It can cost an absolute arm and a leg sometimes, especially if you're travelling peak time. But what if we were to reveal that there might just be a way to slash the cost to just a pound? Yep. Just a quid, you heard right. Thousands of train passengers could bag themselves a bargain using a little-known website called Megatrain, which is run by Stagecoach and sells tickets on trains around the country with pricing starting from just a pound. Does this all sound a bit too good to be true to both of you? Normally in situations like this, I'm a bit sceptical. I think there's probably four seats available at that cost and everything else is around the 50 quid mark.
Yes, I think might is possibly the operational word in might be able to get train tickets for a pound. We did, in fact, reveal this secret to getting train tickets for a pound, and Rachel Rickard-Strauss, our personal finance editor, did an awful lot of research into it. And she has highlighted the train lines that you can use. You can go out from London up towards Leicester, you can go down towards Portsmouth, and there's some running up through the Midlands and up towards Scotland, up through Manchester. But it is really quite difficult to find these tickets on a train line that you might want to use and actually find the tickets, to be perfectly honest.
So for the 6:45 from, I don't know, from Reading into London,
you're not
probably
getting on that.
No hope. Okay.
No. No. But, I mean, mind you, though, on normal trains, you can actually get quite cheap tickets if you don't care when you travel. Mm. I mean, my father-in-law comes down from Shropshire, and he comes down to London on, you know, he doesn't mind when he travels, comes down on, like, a Tuesday afternoon or a Tuesday morning, and he could get a return train ticket for less than 20 quid. But I think the real issue with trains in this country is that people can't afford the train tickets when they actually need to use them on a Friday evening or a Sunday evening or something like that.
And I think, as well, these much-touted kind of cheap advance tickets have really become more scarce over the years, both more scarce but also more well known about. So, you know, they go a lot faster, I think, I think that train tickets get released 3 months before the date of travel. So, you know, if you're looking at Christmas now, all the cheap ones are probably gone several days ago. I certainly find going up north, I used to go up to the Lake District a lot. 10 years ago, if I booked a couple of weeks, 3 weeks in advance, I'd get some cheap tickets, even travelling on a Friday and coming back on a Sunday or Monday. Now, absolutely forget it. No chance. Even if you get in there, you know, 2 months before, they're not there anymore.
That's it. Definite shaking of the head going on there. So it's book in advance, book as soon as they come out and choose the journey and route wisely, I guess. You're listening to Share Radio.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, are still comparing notes today back in the studio for our weekly catch-up, running through some of the stories they've been looking into over the last week. Editor Simon Lambert and Deputy Editor Adrian Lowry are here. Bit of an emotional roller coaster we've had over the last few years, the much-anticipated interest rate rise. But it looks like we're going to have to wait a little while longer, as it's been put on hold again. It's now been at its historic low since the depths of the financial crisis back in 2008. Earlier, we spoke to Share Radio's Billy Bambra and got his reaction to the Bank of England's decision this week.
This has taken no one by surprise at all. We've had exactly the same vote as we had last month, a vote 8-1 to keep interest rates unchanged at their record lows of 0.5%. Been held the same now for 79 months. Ian McCafferty is still the only guy that is voting for a rate rise. He's opted, he wants to see a 0.25% increase in interest rates, but that hasn't happened. That's got a long way to go until it does happen, but still all eyes on the US for interest rate rises first. We are, some people, expecting that to happen early next year. A lot of disagreement, though, whether it will be able to, given the knock-on effect it could potentially have to emerging markets and then, as a result, to developed economies around the US and Europe. But if the US does, that will be certainly the sign pointing to a Bank of England interest rate rise. But until then, we can quite safely say that it's not going to happen.
Share Radio's Billy Bambra. So is now the time to ask if we've all been guilty of making a bit too much of a fuss over this, over a potentially tiny interest rate rise anyway?
Well, I certainly don't want to do down anybody who's worried about, you know, interest rate rises. Of course, you know, you've got to plan ahead. And I think, you know, we should probably just give British households a bit more credit than we do, that most people have been planning ahead and most people have been trimming their finances and looking at remortgaging, et cetera, over the last, you know, year or two. I think what is kind of more amusing in a way is the way that the sort of markets react, or rather, you know, traders and analysts, and also the way that, you know, we in the media cover it. There's been a change in language recently. It's always been, in the last few years, you know, it's always been this feared rate rise, and feared is the adjective that's always been
it's much hyped every month, isn't it?
Exactly.
You said it's been longer in the coming than the Chilcot report, more flagged up than the Millennium Bug, and more insignificant in its impact on the vast majority of family finances than a holiday that turned out to be a bit pricier than expected. So why do we hold our breaths each month and then we go afterwards?
I'm not sure that most households are. I mean, certainly traders and analysts are, and journalists are to an extent. I think as long as households know that the increase will be extremely small, which it will, and then any further increases will be extremely small and slow and gradual, which, you know, Mark Carney has been, you know, doing his best to convince people that they will. I think the vast majority of households will be fine and that they're not panicking about it.
Yeah. What does it mean for us all that it's been held, Simon? And can you just maybe spend a few seconds telling us how it's all decided?
Well, every month the Monetary Policy Committee sits and it looks at all of the data that it has available, particularly to do with inflation, because the main part of their remit is to target inflation at 2%, and also at growth and the rest of the economy and things like productivity. And they make a decision as to whether interest rates need to go up or down or stay on hold. And for 79 months in a row, they've made a decision that they should stay on hold, and they vote on it. There's nine of them. They vote on it. To be honest, I think that for most people, initially, it wouldn't make that much difference. Even if you're on a tracker mortgage, you wouldn't see your actual monthly payments go up by a huge amount. The fear is the cumulative effect of that, you know, pulling money out of the economy. But the problem is that very low interest rates distort the economy, and there's a lot of cheap money flowing around the world that rushes about the place and pushes up asset prices, and it's probably causing bigger problems for 5 years down the line.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
Let's finish with something of an unfinally.
the car,
we do like
plays.
A lighter story, don't yeah. we? Yeah, a bit of an and finally here with weird car insurance claims. Saga has revealed they've had over 500 claims involving animals last year alone. Claims included one driver who claimed just over £1,000 after returning from a walk to discover wild ponies licking his paintwork. A driver who crashed into a bridge to avoid a duck and a motorist whose car was attacked by a rampaging cow. How do insurers work out whether it's an accident or an unavoidable problem or when actually the driver is at fault?
In
situations like this, can they call it either way?
If it's a situation like that, it's your problem because basically the cow isn't insured, so you can't claim off the cow's insurance or the pony's insurance or the deer's insurance. And this happened to me. My wife driving on the M1 on her way up to Northampton for work one morning, a deer ran out in front of the car. In the rush hour, I mean, I don't know who taught this deer its road safety, but it seriously failed the class. Wandered out into the carriageway. My wife hit it square on, basically damaged the car. We had to claim on our insurance. I lost a couple of years off my no claims discount because unfortunately the car was insured in my name. And we couldn't claim any money off the deer.
Yeah. There's nothing you can do. You bear the cost yourself, really.
Nothing.
Is there any advice you can share at all with motorists in situations like this?
I'm a bit sceptical about insurance, full stop. I've never claimed on any insurance policy in all my life. I've paid a lot out in premiums, but I've never claimed anything. And
I almost don't believe
that. If you're a kind of vaguely risky, you know, a person who doesn't mind taking risks, it might actually be worthwhile not having insurance because, you know, the chances of actually claiming, in my experience, are very slim.
There is an investment. I think his name is Lars von Krier or something like that, who basically puts forward that whole argument that insurance is essentially worthless and you don't need it. I think he says basically, yeah, maybe you should pay for car insurance and buildings insurance, but nothing else. I'll dig out his article on it. We'll talk about it on another show.
It's been a privilege and a delight to welcome you both back to the This Is Money podcast here on Share Radio. Editor Simon Lambert and Deputy Editor Adrian Lowry from the award-winning website This Is Money. .co.uk. Back next week. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Share Radio.